Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 30th, 2019. This is the 14th week of our Tuesday 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Karma Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. How many of you know who Jiddu Krishnamurti is?
I hear you talking.
So I better not use it as a reference, but I will anyway. Jiddu Krishnamurti was an amazing thinker. I won't quite say that he was awakened as the Buddha describes awakening, but he was brilliant in his thinking. He passed, I think, within the last 30 years, maybe 40 years. But he had a very powerful impact. I won't give his whole history, but he wrote some great books. He's somebody worth at least reading what he had to say. Jiddu Krishnamurti used to say, he'd start almost every talk, look at the life you're living. What he was referring to was karma. Karma is a present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level of mindfulness, meaning what we hold in mind. A short way of saying that is, if you want to know what your karma is, look in the mirror. Karma is what's unfolding in your life right now in relation to what you're holding in mind. Is everybody following me here so far? So I'm trying to make the explanation I'm trying to counter is the idea that karma is something that is predetermined by past actions that are causing whatever is happening right now to come into fruition. That's not true. That's not what the Buddha understood karma to be. That's how it's often taught. If you did something bad, you're going to have to suffer exactly the same thing. And if you did a lot of bad things, it's going to take a long time of suffering to get through them all. And conversely, if you do a lot of good things, and usually those good things are things that are geared towards reinforcing a certain religious point of view, if you do those things, then you can create some good karma and some happy days for you. Again, that's all speculation, isn't it? And it's dependent on an external system to provide the punishment and the reward for your own behavior. It's not something that I'd ever really want to be involved with, and thank goodness that we are not. We are in absolute control of how we react and respond to what's occurring in our life. And if we react or respond from a mind rooted in ignorance, we will create karma and keep creating karma. So karma is like, if I used a definition of the ocean to say it's wet, salty, and it has uncertain wave patterns, that's a fair description of the ocean. It's enough to understand what it is, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Karma is simply a description of what human life is like when it's rooted in ignorance. It's a description of the ocean of ignorance that we all live in. Does that make sense? Is that a relevant metaphor? Because that's what it is. Karma is the abstract noun that describes the ongoing suffering that arises through five clinging aggregates. So I'm tying this into last week's talk that we learned. Let me go back 2 weeks. Dependent origination states, 3 weeks. Dependent origination states that from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, as a requisite condition comes fabrication. And then from those fabrications comes a corrupted view of life and all manner of confusion, delusion, and ongoing suffering. Clear? And then we learned in the Anuradha Sutta, in other suttas, that because of a fabricated view of life, we create something that the Buddha identified as five clinging aggregates, form, feeling, perception, mental fabrications, and consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, that describe the personal experience of suffering. That's what five clinging aggregates describe. Just like wet, salty, and choppy describes an ocean, ongoing confusion, delusion, and suffering describes, or five clinging aggregates describes confusion, delusion, and suffering. Clear? And then karma is simply the abstract noun that describes the experience of five clinging aggregates. Is that a little bit clear for everyone, or am I going down a dark hole here? So look at the life you're living. That's the key to the Dhamma. And you'll see as I go through this that karma is the immediate experience of the Dhamma, if we're applying it properly. Because karma is occurring when? It's not occurring yesterday or tomorrow. It's occurring right now. So everybody take a breath. Look around. Look at all the smiling faces. The nice weather outside, the pleasant bird words, bird sounds, etc., etc. What you're holding in mind, what you might be worried about tomorrow or getting home early, etc., etc. That's your karma. This is our karma right now. Fortunately, we're in a very pleasant environment and we know what's coming next, hopefully. And so our minds are relatively at calm and not on edge. But if we were in a stressful situation or something that we think is stressful, we might be worried and anxious and distracted. In that moment, that experience is your karma. Is that clear? So your karma has nothing much to do with the environment, because the same mind that's pleasant here is upset there or distracted there. It's the same mind, isn't it? So karma is a problem of the mind, not the environment.
I was just going to say, you can control your karma by what you hold in mind.
Yes, but I would tweak that just a little bit. You can bring cessation to your karma by what you hold in mind, because that's really the whole point. That'll become more clear too. Bonnie?
I'm just curious, how did karma go from this to the idea that the sins of my past are going to visit me today?
I'm going to address that, but I don't mean to cut you off.
No, okay.
But it really is because of a complete dismissal of the Buddhist teachings, for that to be part of Buddhist teachings. But reincarnation and rebirth in the way it's usually presented, the pop culture presentation of karma is really off base for everything. But excuse me.
It's really hard to let that idea go.
It is. But the karma that most people believe in is rooted in the Vedas and the Upanishads, the precursor, the doctrinal precursor of the modern Hinduism, and it's something that the Buddha studied directly and rejected as not leading to his understanding. So that's
he
where
he actually took then this idea of karma and redefined it. Then,
yes, yes, and he did it for a very important reason, because that was a central theme in most people's beliefs during his time and today, and so in order to teach in the brilliant way that he did it, it's this and it's not that, he used common terms that people could relate to and then said, but it's not what you think it is. He took people in a very methodical way, like we do here, to go from a wrong view or a view ignorant of Four Noble Truths, including a view of karma, to a right view or a view of karma rooted in wisdom of Four Noble Truths,
so,
and applied it that way.
So he took it, fixed, and then it got ruined again.
Well,
there was constant pressure to bring it back to, you know, somebody who's whacking you over the head.
Yeah, within the Sangha and within the people that actually followed the Buddha and direct and developed his teachings, it wasn't lost.
But after he passed.
Well, there were people, one of the reasons why the Mahasanghikas, and by the way, the Theravadins, the reason why the Mahasanghikas wanted their own new dharma is one of the reasons is because of karma, because they found that the Buddha's presentation of karma did not allow for future speculative self-establishment in non-physical realms, and that really is the sole reason. So let me read it, because I think some of these questions are great, but I'll address it in the introduction. But if something I'm saying is really confusing to you, please just holler. This is really important. I know I say this often, but this is really where the Buddha Dhamma, where the rubber of the Buddha Dhamma hits the road. And this first couple lines is a common introduction that I put in almost all of my new articles, just because this is important. For a complete understanding of this sutta, within the context intended by an awakened human being, please read the suttas linked in line and at the end of this article, and there's marks for that. Everything the Buddha taught was taught in the context of dependent origination and the ongoing stress, suffering, and distraction that results from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha's first teaching was taught to describe the results of this common ignorance and the singular path he taught to recognize and abandon that ignorance. Many modern Buddhist teachers who misunderstand, misapply, or outright dismiss dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. And I should say, I spent many, many years maybe 10 or 15 years, in a very serious study of modern Buddhism, and I very, very rarely, if ever, I don't think I ever heard Four Noble Truths taught. I heard it mentioned a few times. And dependent origination was never presented the way the Buddha taught. And this is, I mean, I spent many years studying with many of the most foremost teachers and going to all the important centers and temples, etc. Nobody teaches this, and it's an essential teaching of the Buddha. Let me go back. Many modern Buddhist teachers who misunderstand, misapply, or outright dismiss dependent origination and Four Noble Truths do so to dismiss, or rationalize and validate confused and misleading views on karma and rebirth. The resulting dharmas are likewise confused and misleading. Karma, or the Pali word kama, was a common word during the Buddha's time. The common belief in karma is rooted in the Vedas and the Upanishads that Siddhartha Gautama studied prior to his awakening. The Buddha rejected these teachings as they did not lead to his goal of understanding the true nature of human life within ever-changing environment. It's interesting to me that the Buddha to this day is often referred to by many as a yogi, when he was actually an anti-yogi. He didn't believe in the underlying philosophy to that. Many modern Buddhists claim that the Buddha only mentioned karma and rebirth because it was a common teaching of his time, and he only did so to be relevant. That's most of the modern explanation. You don't have to worry about karma. Don't think about it. It's not important. One of the foremost teachers, and I won't mention his name, who has rewritten the Four Noble Truths, believe it or not, teaches this, that don't even think or consider karma and rebirth. They're useless teachings. And you'll see that this is a fundamental teaching. He only did so to be relevant. This is simply another fabricated strategy used by many to continue to ignore ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha used many common words, such as karma, anicca, anatta, dukkha, and many others, in new and unique applications to clearly teach the contrast between his Dhamma and common magical and mystical beliefs of his time. This common misunderstanding of karma and rebirth continues to today. Rather than teach karma and rebirth as irrelevant anachronisms or magical and mystical spiritual attainments, the Buddha taught recognizing the cause and developing the cessation of karma as the central theme of his Dhamma. Karma is not to be seen as a magical system of reward and punishment, hoping for spiritual behavior modification based on gaining notice and favor from disincarnate beings. Karma is not the result of a lack of worship or improper or inadequate chanting or any other rite or ritual. Karma is the direct result of self-supported ignorance of Four Noble Truths. I read it again. Karma is a direct result of self-supported ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So if you want to end your ignorance, what do you do? End your karma and ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Karma is the abstract word the Buddha used to describe the practical experience of five clinging aggregates within an environment of the three marks of existence, an impermanent environment. Karma is the field of play for wise Dhamma practitioners. This comes from the Bhava Sutta. This is a quote from the Buddha. Karma is the field of play. Karma is the field. Consciousness the seed, meaning what we hold in mind is going to feed what we grow in our life. Consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. So craving is continually supplying the sustenance for the seed of consciousness, wrong thinking, to manifest in the field of karma. Is that clear? What a beautiful description, isn't it? Because again, it describes the entire problem. And so if I can recognize and abandon craving, then there's nothing to give rise or feed views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths that will bloom in that field of karma, my life. The field of karma is my life, Frank.
So if you're in right view, then there is no field.
Mm-hmm. Say that again, please.
If you're in right view in the Eightfold Path, there is no field. There's no karma.
There's
no field. If karma is the field, then there's no field for anything to grow.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, that's accurate. I'm hesitant because there's still, if we're talking about field as simply a human life, the field continues.
No, I'm talking about karma as the field.
Yes, yes. A profound awakened right view has brought karma to cessation. And that's not, obviously it's not an impossible task, or the Buddha wouldn't teach it. In fact, excuse me, it is the sole point of the Dhamma.
Well, if you look at what happened to Angulimala, that's a perfect example.
You're learning too much because that was coming up later. But I'll mention it now. It's a good point. So this idea of karma being some spiritual behavior modification system of reward and punishment, and that whatever we do that's hurtful towards others or towards ourselves, we're going to have to suffer likewise. And if it's, like I said before, it's a lot of stuff, it's going to take a long time. It's just not true. There's many teachings where the Buddha intervened on someone's part who was particularly violent and hurtful. They took to the Dhamma and awakened, and they never harmed another soul. And there's two people that I'll talk about. One is Angulimala, the murderer. This is a famous sutta where Angulimala was known as a bloodthirsty murderer, and he was so bloodthirsty that he cut off his victim's fingers, and he'd make a necklace out of it, bleeding down, to scare people, let people know who he was. And he had 99 of those hanging around his neck, and he's looking for 100. And he's walking down the street, and he sees the Buddha walking, coming towards him. And I won't get into, there's a longer story to this that I won't get into. Anyway, they approach. The Buddha teaches Angulimala the Dhamma very briefly. Angulimala awakens, and he never harmed another soul. So the idea that Angulimala would have to suffer at least 100, be murdered 100 times to balance these scales of karma, obviously not. What that sutta teaches is that when you take to the Dhamma and awaken, karma has come to cessation. And it's not a way of escaping past hurts, because all of those are rooted in, are like foam on the ocean too, aren't they? Ultimately, things that have happened in the past. They're not real. They're not what's occurring right now. So again, karma is not some universal justice system either. Some people might scream about that. Well, where's the justice? Who cares? The point is to awaken, to bring karma to cessation. The other one I was going to mention is King Ashoka, who was one of the most bloodthirsty rulers of all time. You heard me mention him. The term head on a pike was coined by Ashoka when he would overtake a country or a town, which he did often. He would cut their heads off and put them on pikes. So the next town knew, you better be careful, because anyway, Ashoka took to the Buddha's Dhamma. And rather than have to suffer thousands and thousands of murders to himself, he awakened and he had a wonderful life.
So why is it craving or clinging and it's not ignorance?
Oh, because, great question, because ignorance arises from craving for, and ultimately it's craving for self-establishment in any way possible. And when we recognize that level of ignorance, we say we cease eye-making and we cease craving. So the focus is very narrowly put on that one thing, to notice this, because it's in... Craving is what's occurring in this moment. So again, it's another word for karma, and it's directing my karma. So something happens. Karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by what I'm holding in mind. So what occurs right now, if what I'm holding in mind is still rooted in ignorance, I am reacting to it, I'm imprinting my conditioned mind further, and I'm continuing ignorance because I want this situation to be different in the moment. That's craving. Is that clear, David?
I understand it. It just seems like taken to the Dhamma, like Angulimala, he didn't just take to it. He had to understand and have right view that he was ridding himself of the ignorance. Therefore, there wouldn't be clinging. So that's the source of drying up that.
Well, and again, remember the analogy. Mm-hmm. It's our craving that provides the sustenance mm-hmm. for continued ignorance. And the Buddha often talks about this too, about how we continue to feed our ignorance. So he's addressing that very matter of providing nourishment for our own ignorant views, mm-hmm. consciousness.
And it just plays itself out by with the clinging.
It's continued by clinging, yes. By clinging, specifically clinging to wrong views. Mm. The underlying way we usually experience clinging to wrong views is we we try to play this little magic act on ourselves and take that clinging to wrong views and apply it to an object of something that we want. And so it's a little bit difficult at first to recognize that by my clinging to an object or a result of something that I prefer, the underlying cause of that is still ignorance, is still a wrong view.
Isn't it that feedback loop that the Buddha awakened to?
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Okay, let me continue. Somebody keeps joining and signing off. Okay. Bound by craving and established in wrong view. Established in wrong view, renewed becoming is produced. That's the end of that little sutta. Remember, we talked about becoming. Each moment holds the opportunity. In fact, you could say that karma unfolding holds the opportunity to either continue ignorance and become further ignorant, or to start integrating right refined mindfulness, the Eightfold Path, and start becoming awakened. That's the whole point of that. I think it's the seventh or eighth part of dependent origination. From clinging and maintaining comes becoming. From becoming comes birth. That's what the Buddha is referring to. And that is the choice within karma that we have each and every moment. Karma means action. Karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level of mindfulness. It is from a well-concentrated mind that one is able to be mindful, to hold in mind each factor of the Eightfold Path. Is that clear? Because again, those two sentences are the entire Dhamma practice right there. Really, everybody understands that? Okay. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of the Eightfold Path as the framework and guidance for Dhamma practice. The Eightfold Path develops the profound ability to recognize and abandon fabricated views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. This is the entire purpose of the Buddha's Dhamma, to recognize and abandon all fabricated views arising from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Karma is the ongoing experience of ignorance. Ending ignorance of Four Noble Truths ends the unfolding of karma. Guaranteed. A mind rooted in ignorance is a mind distracted towards continued ignorance, or distracted towards continuing to become further ignorant. And that's the real, I talked about Krishnamurti. That's the difference between Krishnamurti and the Buddha. Krishnamurti understood that the problem is the way that we think, but he could only teach that the problem is the way we think and you should think this way. But he did not understand that people, because of the nature of ignorance and the subtle and powerful strategies that we all employ to ignore ignorance, requires an Eightfold Path in order to go from wrong views to right views, from wrong thinking to right thinking. That's the significant difference between Krishnamurti and the brilliance of what the Buddha taught. He understood we need a path. A mind rooted in ignorance is a mind distracted towards continued ignorance. The Buddha taught Shamatha Vipassana meditation for the sole purpose of deepening. Why is that line in there? Sorry about that. For the sole purpose of deepening concentration so as to support the refined mindfulness necessary to hold in mind the Eightfold Path. You've heard me say that a few times. Understanding karma is recognizing and abandoning all individual contributions to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing and unsatisfactory experiences, in a word, dukkha. A well-informed analysis of karma shows that karma is an ongoing aspect of dukkha and several significant themes of the Buddha's Dhamma. Excuse me. Karma arises from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So obviously the solution is to end ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Ignorance of Four Noble Truths results in painful consequences of one's actions. Karma means action. The five clinging aggregates are the personal experience of dukkha or suffering driven by karma. So you can say that this karmic field that we all create in ourselves is the field that is providing motivation for our own personal experience of suffering. rooted in craving and clinging. Wrong views of self, anatta, is continued to ignorance of Four Noble Truths, that is experienced as karma unfolding. So again, you could say that anatta, my wrong views of self, are unfolding as this experience known as karma. Remember, karma isn't good or bad, it's simply this field of experiential ignorance. It's a good way of putting it. The field of experiential ignorance. Would somebody write that down? The field of experiential ignorance. Yeah. It is. I mean, every now and then I get one right. All karma is rooted in ignorance. That's an important thing to remember. There is no good karma or bad karma. A mind conditioned towards self-identification and continued conceit is a mind clinging to five clinging aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's a long sentence, but just reaffirming that point, that if we're experiencing confusion, delusion, and suffering, it's because we are ignorant of Four Noble Truths. The five clinging aggregates describe the ongoing personal experience of stress and suffering arising from ignorance. Attempting to manipulate future karma is always rooted in ignorance and continued eye-making and can only continue to prolong dukkha. That's how most of karma is taught. In fact, a lot of the rituals and rites, etc., of modern Buddhism and many modern spiritual practices are taught. Kind of like the Ten Commandments are a teaching on, and I don't mean any disrespect, are a teaching on Christian karma. In other words, if you can start living within the framework of those Ten Commandments, when you die, you're going to get your reward for that type of good behavior. You're altering your karma. The same thing is taught in almost exactly the same terms in modern Buddhism, that there's things that you need to do in this life, and there's almost an endless list, including a lot of different rites and rituals, some of them that contradict each other. You'll do these things as a Buddhist practice so that when you die in a future life, and it might be a million lifetimes in the future, but if you address it now, at some point in the endless future, you might have a good day. That's not karma. Again, karma has nothing to do with what might happen. It has everything to do with what is happening. Rebirth and reincarnation are also central themes of the Buddha's Dhamma and closely related to karma. The Buddha understood that fabricating a view of the birth-death cycle is cruel, creating scenarios for the continued establishment of the self in any non-physical or speculative realm. There's nothing more cruel than that. He understood that doing so would only provide a strategy for continuing ignorance by establishing a self in speculative and imaginary non-physical realms. He avoided fabricating yet another foolish explanation of commonly held views that insist on seeing self in some way as eternal. The Buddha teaches to bring to cessation any moment rooted in ignorance so as not to give birth to continued ignorance and continued dukkha. That's the most important teaching on birth that the Buddha gives. He doesn't discount future birth, but what he's asking us to develop a well-concentrated mind for is so we could be mindful of what we're giving birth to in this moment and in the next moment. Because that's the only thing that we have control over, and it's actually the only significant aspect of birth that relates to the Buddha's Dhamma. If we find ourselves thinking about speculative reincarnated births, we're stuck in fabrication. Recognize it and abandon it, because it's not helpful to what's occurring now. It is at the point of contact between what is held in mind and what is currently arising in thought, word, and deed that a well-concentrated mind can apply the guiding principles of the Eightfold Path through wise restraint. So again, we've talked a lot about practicing restraint at the point of contact between what's occurring and my five senses and that sixth sense of my thinking, my consciousness. And so that point of contact is our karmic field. We are in it right now, in each and every moment. And so if we can introduce wise restraint at that moment, if we hope to end our karma, we must introduce wise restraint in our life as our life unfolds. And what is wise restraint? Simply means to stop creating self-reference, self-identification, clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas in this moment. And we've talked about this often. So when you find yourself reacting and possibly causing additional karma, remind yourself, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. Because if you want to know what your karma is, you can look in the mirror, but it still doesn't define you. As in all things that are fabricated, karma itself is like foam on the ocean, except we have to deal with that. Is that clear what I just said?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the essence of the Dhamma, but it's not something that's unattainable. It's completely attainable. In fact, it's the point of the Dhamma. It is in this present moment that karma is unfolding, and it is in this present moment that the guiding framework of the Eightfold Path is applied. I think everybody's clear on that, right? I mean, we have to go through a process of deepening our concentration, intellectually learning the Eightfold Path, and then slowly integrating it into our life as the framework and guidance for our lives, which means now it can directly address karma.
I found that the Eightfold Path are really ignored or kind of fly by it is right intention. And I think that has a lot to do with understanding karma and the Four Noble Truths.
Absolutely. I mean, the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path for a reason. If you leave one of them out, you're missing it. Especially that. I mean, in some ways you could say that right intention is the most important one, but it really isn't. But it can't be overlooked, and it has to be understood. So right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. Another way to say that would be right intention is the intention to recognize all manifestations of ignorance. Another way of saying that is right intention is the intention to recognize that I'm within this karmic field that I created.
It's like jumping into, I think I kind of know how to build a house, but I really don't, because I really don't know why I'm doing it.
Yeah.
If you have right intention, you know what you're doing this all for.
Yeah, yeah. I built my first three houses not knowing what I was doing. The karmic debt was big on those. Frank, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. That didn't really happen, by the way. Karma and rebirth are simple understandings made overly complicated by confused and irrelevant, wrong, or ignorant views. However, it is simple. In relation to karma and rebirth, the Buddha concisely teaches, I am the owner of my actions, the heir to my actions. I am born of my actions and related through my actions. My actions will determine the fortune or misfortune in my life. What could be more clear than that? And that's also a direct teaching on what we're giving birth to in this moment. My actions will determine what I give birth to in this moment, the fortune or misfortune in my life. So I don't want to get too deep into rebirth. One thing I wanted to say, there's hardly, that's not the right way to say it, there's not that many suttas that teach karma directly, which some might find, or even rebirth directly, which some might find confusing because they're so important. But karma is an aspect of each and every teaching the Buddha ever gave. As I just said, it's an aspect of dukkha, it's an aspect of impermanence, it's an aspect of not-self. It's an aspect of the three marks of existence. It's an aspect of continued ignorance. It's all part of karma. So it's actually a simple teaching to describe the ocean in that way, the field. But it's the application that is critical, that we are applying the teachings in a realistic and authentic way. And we'll get to that in a minute.
You're just quoting from now, he actually says, how do you stop karma?
Yeah. Teaches
right,
you.
Right action, right speech, right life.
There's nothing to it. There really, and there's certainly nothing that any human being couldn't do.
Right. And what you were saying before, like this is where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm sorry.
And I was looking at it, because the virtuous factors have always been fascinating to me. As why, when you get to practice right speech and right action, it actually feels good.
Yeah.
There's
especially when you're mindful of it. You're doing it purposely.
Yeah, there's a satisfaction to that.
Yeah.
And I realize it's your feeling the falling away of the karma.
Yep, and the freedom of abandoning fabrications, at least in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and in that way, you could say that that's where karma gets kind of confused with religion and the moral aspects,
mm-hmm.
and that all we have to do, and so many people think that all, in order to be a good Buddhist, I just have to act morally pure. Well,
right.
If that's rooted in a fabrication, I'll be the most wonderful person in the world if I act morally pure,
yeah.
You miss the point again. You might not hurt people or hurt yourself, but you're not developing anything towards awakening. You'll
right.
be a nice person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any actions motivated by ignorance of Four Noble Truths, meaning fabricated actions, will directly impact one's experience of what is currently arising. A mind rooted in continued ignorance can only give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. That's karma. A mind whose views are framed by the Eightfold Path can now give birth to a moment inclined towards becoming free of karma. Again, that's the Dhamma right there. This is awakening. In this way, the Buddha is not dismissing the notion of future physical births, nor is he placing any value on future or manipulating future physical births. He simply teaches that future lives are at best irrelevant speculation and to be mindful of what one is giving birth to in this moment. The Buddha's Dhamma and the Noble Eightfold Path provides the complete framework and continual guidance to recognize and abandon all fabricated views arising from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and so end all karma. Okay, the sutta, finally. You're saying that that's the wrong... Okay, I've got to check that too.
Yeah.
It's not... I have in here Anguttara Nikaya 35.145, and Raman's tells me that that's not the case, so I'll correct that. Ah... On one occasion, the Buddha addressed those gathered. Listen and pay close attention, friends, and I will teach you past and current karma, the cessation of karma, and the path and practice leading to the cessation of karma. In other words, he's going to give this complete Dhamma practice, Dhamma teaching. Past karma is to be seen as the sixth sense base. So that was confusing to you, that statement.
No, it's a bit I got.
Oh, okay. So the Buddha is just simply saying the sixth sense base, that our five physical senses and that sixth sense, our thinking, our consciousness, depending on where the level is, it's going to contribute to more painful experiences or not. But so my sixth senses are informing me and highlighting my experience in the present moment. So the six senses are the visceral experience of my karma. A simpler way of saying it is we are conscious and feeling beings. How else would we understand things except through what's coming in contact with our six senses? Is that clear? Not that hard. Karma and the... I'm going to say it again. And the path and practice leading to the cessation of karma. Past karma is to be seen as the sixth sense base. Karma is fabricated by intention and experienced by sense contact. Clear, right? The sixth sense base is past karma. We're holding... That's a better way to describe this. Past experiences rooted in ignorance condition our mind. Our conditioned mind is then manifested and expressed through our six senses. So our six senses are neither ignorant or wise, but the underlying understanding will inform our senses on how to interpret, the world that we're experiencing. And so if the underlying understanding is pure and framed by the Eightfold Path, then our sixth sense base will allow us to interpret what's occurring framed by the Eightfold Path. If not, our sixth sense base is interpreting what's occurring from the point of view of ignorance. And so that is where it's felt. So again, karma and awakening is experienced at the sixth sense base, at the point of contact. Clear? Okay. My comment. A mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths is constantly reacting to ordinary phenomena arising and passing away. This contact with phenomena occurs and is experienced through the six senses. A distracted mind stuck in self-referential views continually reinforces ignorance and continues confusion, deluded thinking, and stress and suffering. Karma arises from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, the Buddha's words. Current karma is fabricated. Current karma is fabricated thoughts, words, and deeds, actions, arising and passing away. So any thought, word, and deed that is fabricated is our current karma. My comment. Dependent origination shows that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that establishes fabricated views in all manner of stress and suffering, the Buddha's words. Cessation of karma is the release from ignorance of Four Noble Truths and the three forms of stress and suffering. Remember, we talked about this during the Dukkha Sutta a couple weeks ago. The three forms of stress and suffering of bodily, verbal, and mental fabrications, or fabrications in general. This is the cessation of karma. So, recognizing and abandoning fabrications, the second part of dependent origination, brings karma to cessation. Another way of looking at karma is that karma is a human life that's out of control. Because we are simply experiencing the reaction to our conditioned thinking. Rather than, and the Vitakasanthana Sutta, as Buddha teaches, we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it, meaning when it's appropriate. So again, it's a teaching of going from wrong view or wrong thinking to right view or right thinking.
So restraint doesn't eliminate the karma.
Eventually it will.
I get confused by restraint. Because restraint seems to be something that is placed at the point of contact, and it has nothing to do with cessation of the ignorance that causes the dukkha. And I think maybe I'm thinking of it as a very base level thinking about what restraint is. But it just seems like, why are you figuring this out? You need to show restraint at that point where you recognize it. And that doesn't seem to be part of taking to the Dhamma and replacing ignorance with the wisdom to have the right view.
What a great question, because it gets to the heart of today's talk. Karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level of our mindfulness. Meaning, so that mindfulness, the present level of mindfulness for a wise Dhamma practitioner is well framed by the Eightfold Path. So as disturbance is arising in contact with the sixth sense space, we practice restraint at that point. What it means is that we use our well-concentrated mind and the newly developing right or correct or realistic view to see what's occurring right now from that framework, rather than continuing to react to it, which will only further, if we don't practice restraint at that point, it will only further ignorance. So it doesn't, the Dhamma practice, hold on 1 second, Frank. Dhamma practice doesn't mean, it doesn't mean that we don't have anything to do, it means just the opposite. So it's at that point that we recognize that we are stuck in a fabrication or experiencing the result of a fabrication, that we do apply restraint, meaning not going any further with that. And what's the right word? Interjecting, incorporating our understanding of the Dhamma in that moment.
It's a fruition moment.
Yeah, but is that clear?
I think I'm just thinking in absolutes.
Oh, that's always going to get us in difficulties, because there isn't.
So the restraint is really applying right action, right speech.
Yes.
That's the restraint.
Yeah, are you suggesting that I don't think this is right, but I just want to address it. I don't think this is what you're saying, but I do want to address it because I'm thinking of it. Are you saying that when we practice restraint, then
it's a
all fabrications are over and we're now awakened?
No, it almost seems like it's a device that you will practice restraint before the awakening begins. Like I asked you this once before, does the Buddha does he have to practice restraint?
I think that word, practice.
I mean, post-awakening.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, I think the best way to say that is, and I don't mean to dismiss your question, it doesn't matter because he's awakened. What's important is to understand that we, as unawakened human beings, must practice restraint. And it is at that point of contact. So we practice restraint as one of the skills or tools or strategies that we use as part of the Eightfold Path to awaken. So we practice restraint at the point of contact until we're awakened. Once we're awakened, let me put it this way. Then an awakened human being is... an awakened human being is the epitome of wise restraint without putting any thought to it. It's simply the way we live our lives. Maybe a silly example is when I was drinking, I spent a lot of times in bars. Most drinkers do. When I stopped drinking, I didn't. I simply didn't put myself in that environment anymore. It's really the same thing. Once we get... but I still lived in the world. That's the point I was making with that. I cut out that one little thing that was so important to me previously. Now it's something that I eliminate and leave behind me because I am concerned about my well-being now.
But in that context, you had right view. But without that right view, you would have had to show this restraint not to go in that bar.
I still showed restraint, but it was...
but that could fail. Restraint could fail.
Well, wait. This is important. Restraint could fail. That, again, and many people do. That's why we need to be mindful of the Eightfold Path moment by moment in our lives. But the restraint that allowed me to walk past Flynn's Tavern was something, it wasn't really Dhamma related. It was related, though, in my thinking about, I want to be a sober human being. And so in that moment, as I'm walking by the bar and I'm hearing the glasses, hearing the glasses tinkling, people laughing, and the smell of beer, and I think, boy, just one would be nice. And my next thought was, I can't have just one. That's restraint. And it's just that simple and direct. In the Dhamma, as my mind, I'm finding myself reacting and getting upset or projecting my thoughts into the future or trying to establish a speculative, non-physical experience for myself, I practice restraint and say, wait a minute. This is a fabricated view. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am. Take a breath and just come back to the moment. And that type of restraint is really the essence of Dhamma practice. At some point, it leads to... in fact, if you read the Nagara Sutta, maybe I should teach this again, or I will on retreat. If you read the Nagara Sutta, what the Buddha is referring to towards the end of that sutta where he's awakening is he's now learned how to apply restraint. Is that clear?
Yeah.
It's such an important point that you bring...
it's the word.
Yeah,
And it's also like, this is this toolbox, and I will... in the meantime, I'm going to use this restraint, which doesn't seem
restraint is
the toolbox is the Eightfold Path.
Exactly.
Restraint is the fruition of actively being engaged in the Eightfold Path, is why I say
restraint is the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
Eightfold Path is the practice of restraint.
Yeah.
From used to say, I don't have to think about it anymore.
Hmm.
And that's not restraint. That's just because you're practicing.
No, it's developing restraint.
I don't have to.
It's the word I think.
Yeah,
practice throws people.
Restraint is like it's like a hammer. When you got a nail to put in,
right?
It's good to have a hammer around.
Mm-hmm.
But when you got to tighten a nut, you're better off with a wrench. So restraint is this tool or the skill that we use, again at that point of contact. But it's not an absolute thing, and it might be that if we. Restraint doesn't relate to an absolute context because it's something that we use within impermanence, within karma.
And it's not necessarily an effort. That's what I was referring to.
Mm-hmm.
I still practice restraint, but I don't have to whack myself over the head to do it.
Yeah, you've heard me say...
It's clear in the situation that this is what I should do. And that's always
automatic.
Restrained.
Automatic.
It's automatic?
Yeah. Frank, do you and Eric have to leave at 8:30?
Yeah.
You do? Can you go a little bit longer, like 5 or 10 minutes so I can finish the soup?
I've got a long day.
All right, let me try to finish it.
I always listen to it.
Okay, all right. Let me see where I can go here. This is the cessation of karma, the Buddha's words. The path leading to the cessation of karma is precisely, you don't have to leave, is precisely the Noble Eightfold Path. See you, Eric. See you, Frank.
Bye, Eric.
That's the
Bye.
End.
Bye.
That's the end of the sutta. You got, Frank, you have any comment on this? I know you had your hand up. Come on, you got 5 minutes.
No, that was pretty much all I wanted to say was kind of what was already said. I think it's like, for me, you know, practicing restraint seems like a lot of effort, like Ron was saying. But when I'm applying right mindfulness and I'm thinking about each factor of the path and I'm in a current situation and I can see the arising of dukkha or my eye-making, it's through not engaging with the eye-making that the restraint is applied.
Yeah.
It's not a practice. It's own, and I think that's the word that can throw me off, too, is practice. So I'm not, it's more like a fruition moment of everything coming to life in the present moment.
Yeah, thank you. Have a safe trip. Good to see you. See you, Eric.
Hi, Eric.
You've heard me say this before, but the more that I integrated the Eightfold Path, the more real freedom that I had in my life. And it because I didn't have to be always monitoring my behavior and second guessing did I do something right. Mm-hmm. Because our behavior becomes framed by the Eightfold Path. And so it's naturally harmless towards ourselves and others. It's naturally compassionate. It's naturally mindfully inclusive of others. But there's great freedom in that. And so getting back, it's such a good point you brought up, David. So as we develop the Dhamma, initially practicing restraint might be something that we can almost get a little stressed at. Am I doing it right now? Do I need to be doing it now? When am I doing it? But as we start developing the Dhamma and our minds become more concentrated and we understand how it works, it simply becomes an ongoing automatic expression of how we live our lives. We practice restraint. Just like using that, maybe that's silly, but just like I do when I walk by a bar, I don't have to think about it anymore. You know, it's automatic. It's not a problem. Or anything else, you know, that I've given up. I used to smoke for many years. I don't think about it. I don't have to practice restraint right now to not take a cigarette, but for about 2 weeks that was all I was doing, was restraining myself.
So, well, 2 weeks.
2 weeks. Good. Well, and then I went to 2 weeks lasted about 3 days. Then I went to an acupuncturist in Staten Island. It was remarkable. He did this auricular acupuncture, and he was NLP practitioner, repatterning your thinking. I spent 10 minutes with the needles and listening to him talk. Never even thought of having a cigarette again after that. And I was a 3-pack a dayer. So, again, no restraint there. But, you know, you could say that the practical restraint was, because I recognized I didn't have enough restraint myself, was to go find someone to assist my restraint in quitting cigarettes. The Eightfold Path is the same way, getting back to Krishnamurti. Most human beings, the Buddha realized, don't know how to practice restraint and aren't capable of it because they're lacking the framework in which to implement restraint. The Eightfold Path, to know how to do it. You could also say that in that way, the Eightfold Path provides us the means for recognizing what is skillful and wholesome in our lives and recognizing and abandoning what is hurtful and distracting. And again, that's a teaching on karma. So, remarkable teaching. We're going to go around the room, but any questions directly on karma and rebirth? And we didn't touch much, I didn't touch much on rebirth, but you understand that it doesn't need much more explanation, does it, as far as the Buddha's teaching? All right?
Yeah, you know, there's still some, the refined explanation where, how karma and rebirth are really connected, you know, when there is rebirth, you know, that there's not the soul passing on, it's just this continuation of karma that's happening.
Oh, that aspect of it.
Yeah.
Karma unfolding for someone who has not developed the Dhamma and passes away. What happens there?
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha wouldn't speculate on it, so I won't. And I, mm-hmm. but he didn't. he always answered those types of questions in a similar way by saying, "Don't concern yourself with that. It's just a distraction. You can awaken right now in this lifetime. So why would you care about?" These are my words. Now, why would you care about where you're going in a next lifetime? To me, that's an irresponsible response to not wanting to deal with my life right now and awaken. And it does take, it takes a measure of courage and a measure of accepting true responsibility for our lives, doesn't it? Because it's much easier, it's much easier to just not have to change anything, isn't it? To just continue the struggle and think that I'm doing everything right and not pay attention to anything. It does take a lot of courage and responsibility to basically admit that the way I'm looking at myself in relation to the world doesn't work. Let me find another way to look at the world. And that's what the Buddha taught. And wrong views are karma. Right views are awakening. Really good discussion. Let me get Jane on first. Jane, what do you have to say for yourself? Jane. Hello, Jane. No, she's still muted. Jane. Hello, Jane. Matt, good to see you.
Good to see you, John.
I think she stepped away.
Good to see everybody. Good question, David. Good.
Yeah.
Good thinking. I'll save it for another time.
Thank you, Matt. Lorna, you a little more clear on karma?
It's confirmed what I thought it was, yes.
Good.
I think it's funny that you started off with the deep blue sea. I think the way I think about it, which is probably incorrect of trying to work out what karma is like if you're a fish that's always lived in the sea, he probably doesn't know he's in water, you know, because he's always had that up, that he's always been there, and until he gets, he's pulled out of the water, then he would not have the water, and then when he goes back in, then he'll appreciate the water, he'll experience the water differently. And I think it's a bit like that with karma, that because I've always had karma, I'm in karma. I've never, as far as I know, ever been without karma. It's hard to see it because I'm right up nose to nose with it all the time.
Yep.
And I wish I could sort of like step outside to look inside to see what it is, you know, which obviously you can't do. Like the fish would need to come out of the water and go back into the water to see it again with fresh eyes.
Yeah. That's it. I'm sorry.
That's it, really. It's just the way of sort of thinking about it.
Yeah, the way you're thinking about it is in the abstract, which is the way you should think about it. But understand that the experience of karma is what's occurring. It's the five clinging aggregates. It's my view of myself in relation to the world around me.
And what has occurred. And what has occurred, well, and what is occurring.
You can extrapolate it to the past only as far as saying that, yes, those experiences in the past were the result of karma too, or the result of ignorance. But going any further than that is not helpful.
No.
Because then we can get into, okay, what can I do to make me have a nice, good karma day tomorrow? Nothing, except change the way you think.
Mm.
You know, take to the Dhamma and awaken.
But yeah.
That's the point. Yeah, and again, the whole point of clarity is that we create karma. It's got nothing to do with anything outside of ourselves. It's up to us how we experience our lives. Thank you. Okay, good to see you again. How have you been?
See you too.
Good.
I don't really have anything specific to add. There's a lot to think about. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, good. Did you find it useful?
Yeah.
Ah, good. Good. And you know these are all taped and you can listen to them over again.
Okay, yeah, thank
good.
You.
Glad you joined us tonight. Ron, good to see you.
Good to be here.
This is definitely a lot clearer than the previous time.
Thanks a lot.
The last time, I think I was at a retreat.
It's probably at a retreat the last time I taught Quantum Rebirth.
I came away still fairly, not having a good view of it. This time, it's now hidden.
Good. I think I'll use this suit on retreat rather than what's in Becoming Buddha. Good. Glad you're here. Good evening, Helen. How are you?
Good evening. I'm fine. John, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
Good. I don't think I have anything new to add, really. I think everything in life really is about how you're dealing with it in the present moment.
Yeah. Yeah, whether you're a Dhamma practitioner or not.
Right.
Yeah.
So we are just lucky that we have the Eightfold Path to help us deal with each moment.
Yeah. Well said. Thank you. David, good to see you. Thank you for that talk.
I'm good.
Glad you're here. Andrew, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
I try to distill things down to the simplest form so it stays in my mind. And it seems to me that the karma or rebirth, as it is, described as simply what you're thinking about all day. If you're thinking in terms of self-aggrandizement and eye-making fed by clinging and craving, then that's negative and that's bad karma. But if you're thinking in terms of Eightfold Path, thinking very differently, then that's a kind of rebirth.
It is. Mm-hmm. And it's up to you what you give birth to. Well, you simplified it beautifully, because that's the point. And it got nothing to do with what I'm going to be in 3 million years. It has everything to be. My life, my understanding, my mindfulness has everything to do with what I'm going to experience now and the next now. And that's all that's important in the Dhamma, too. Because the only thing that's ever occurring is, and I'm not going to say the now moment, because we've made now this new kind of religion that we always have to be in the now. Life is a continuum, and what we need to be is well concentrated and mindful of that continuum unfolding and be free of the need for it to be any different than it is, because it can't be. It just is what it is. Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good. Like what Ram was saying, sometimes I get lost, I hold on to one idea, but the whole concept sort of became much clearer to me about each of the parts of being connected. But I kept thinking of the word responsibility, and then just before you reiterated something you said, I can't quite remember exactly what you said, but it feels like that moment is well, it's so funny, because when I go to say it, then it gets all muddled, but it was like really clear in there. But being when I can be responsible for my fabrications and understanding that applying the Eightfold Path in that moment, then the karma can fall away. And I love the idea of that image of the field and the seed and the moisture is such a beautiful image, and I hate to think like it's karmic, because you've disappeared and you lose that beautiful growth. But it really, the more that you fabricate, maybe that growth becomes more like weedy and all tangled and
metastasized.
But
it is like a cancer.
But for me, it's like, I think it's sometimes it's easier, and when you're conscious in a good way, or you're aware of applying the Eightfold Path, so that I can be responsible to have the restraint. The restraints to me is a tool to change my being, because if I want to feel something different, I want to know something, I have to change my behavior.
Yep.
And the restraint is my way of being responsible to to, you know, whether it's applying to, you know, eating the half a loaf of bread or it's what I'm about to say to somebody. So having, it's like make it, for me, it makes me responsible as hard as it can be sometimes, depending upon how close I am to the contact when, you know, Lorna was saying so close. So just saying it out loud helps me to kind of understand that I create that metastasizing stuff by, and I'm a good fabricator. So it's really, really helpful.
Yeah. Well put, yeah. Bonnie. We are responsible, or maybe a way to say it, restraint is the act of a responsible Dhamma practitioner.
Say that again.
Restraint is there is the res, how did I say it?
The act.
The act of a responsible Dhamma practitioner.
Yeah.
That's where we practice our responsibility.
Right.
To incorporate the Dhamma. Another the word restraint could be seen as another word for simply integrating the Dhamma or practicing the Dhamma in this moment. And we are responsible for that. In fact, you could say in a very broad but important way, we are responsible, period. And that's a good thing to hold in mind. Because when I am, I can accurately say that all the difficulty in my life came when I was insisting that I wasn't responsible for what was occurring. And it's just from the addict point of view, drinking bottles and bottles of vodka. I was never responsible for that. Or the other things. I'm just using that as an example. Whether we're Dhammic practitioners or not, the key to life is being responsible for your actions. But the Buddha is saying that if you want to awaken, you'd be responsible within this framework. That's what we're responsible for. And it's the ultimate responsibility, I believe.
Just one more point, and then I'm going to stop. But that, I just had this other image of that field, the growth and the wanting to believe that and clinging to it. But by allowing it, for me to allow it to let go, can remind me that it can be impermanent. It doesn't have to.
Yeah.
Be there.
It's all impermanent.
Not been there.
Yeah, foam on the ocean. And even the visual relates that, doesn't it? A field that's growing, whatever it's growing, is impermanent. Growing stuff, it all dies and new stuff can grow. So depending on the moisture in the seed, we're going to grow the field of our life, our karma. Karma is the field, consciousness the seed, craving the moisture. Look at those three things. What am I craving for? It's skillful craving to crave for awakening, isn't it? And that type of craving, chanda, skillful desire, feeds my consciousness, the seed. And so now that seed can grow in my karmic field, the field of awakening. My field now becomes a field of awakening rather than a field of ignorance. Good way to put it. Liz.
Good to be here. I don't.
What was that other brilliant thing I said that I forgot?
Experience.
It's on the record.
Experience. Something experience.
Yeah. It was so brilliant I forgot it. Liz, I'm sorry.
Is the practice is...
It's so far from me, right?
It
couldn't have been all that brilliant if none of us can remember it. It wasn't a memorable line, was it? I'm sorry, Liz.
No, that's okay. I don't really have anything to add. I'm looking forward to listening to this again.
I am too, especially now. Thank you, Liz. Good to see you again.
You too.
Hi, Russ. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. For me also, it brought a lot of clarity, this on karma, which I didn't have before. And you know, it really boils down to, do we want to stay in ignorance and propagate that karma, or do we want to live in the Eightfold Path? And
yes. Yeah, and again, that's restraint. That's where we practice restraint. And it does come down to that simple choice. In each, do I want to continue ignorance or do I want to awaken? And sometimes you might choose ignorance. And guess what? That's okay. That's why the practice, that's why it's a practice.
Yeah.
And not, you know, and then so the path will remind us that, wait a minute, you just chose ignorance and this is what you're getting because of it. But because the path is timeless, you get to choose again. Choose awakening. Nick, good to see you.
I think you said responsibility is the practitioner's act of restraint.
Yeah, it was something else.
I
think it was so brilliant that it just blew all our minds.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll listen to it
we'll
again.
We'll get a t-shirt out of it.
Probably a simple question, but the chapter is called the chapter is called Karma and Rebirth.
Yeah.
But through most of what you were talking about, the term rebirth doesn't come up all that often, but awakening comes up. Is awakening and rebirth the same thing?
Wow. In a sense, it is, because we are giving birth to awakening, and in the Dhammic sense, in the sense of the Dhamma, that's an accurate statement. That the whole point of integrating and practicing the Eightfold Path is so that we can give birth or give rise to an awakened presence. So yeah, that's the whole point. What am I giving birth to in this moment? It's my choice. I can either walk into the bar or continue developing the Dhamma. I can give in to anger and greed and frustration and fear and all the rest of it in this moment because of the field that I've developed, because of the seed that I've planted. Or I can recognize that these aren't vegetables that I want to eat and flowers that I want to see anymore. I want to see something different. I want to awaken. And so I'll provide different sustenance to what my own life. And that sustenance is framed by the Eightfold Path. That's why the Buddha uses that term, sustenance. What are we feeding ourselves? What are we feeding our minds? If we're feeding our minds from views rooted in ignorance, prone to craving and clinging, what else could we possibly become except further ignorant? But if we feed, if we introduce into our field of karma these wisdom teachings, what are we going to grow? We're going to grow in wisdom. And eventually we'll give birth to awakening. And it's not a lifetimes in the future eventuality. It's right now. Or maybe next week. Kate got it because she sat in that seat tonight. I always look forward to teaching class. But I was really looking forward to teaching this class just because of such an important sutta and where it fits into our teaching. I think it fits in nicely, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to finish up our Dharma. Did I use the word Dharma?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to finish up our Dhamma study next week with hindrances. And then there's going to be one or two other suttas that I'll begin to introduce. There's a couple of suttas on reincarnation that I'm going to teach sometime in the near future because I realize I haven't. But it really is not, it's not that broad of a subject within the Buddha's Dhamma. It's just that. What am I giving birth to in this moment is the important teaching on birth, so. Any other questions? Let's finish with metta, as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditative posture. Excuse me. Gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth.
Boy.
And take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for an outstanding class tonight. Peace. Thank you, Jane, for joining.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.